This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. There's a lot of talk about the violence that affects urban America, and it is a serious problem. Drive-by shootings, carjackings, and other crime affects the fabric of this country. But very little of that violence has the sectarian underpinnings of the time known as the Troubles, which plagued the Northern Ireland city of Belfast for three decades, starting in 1969.
Writer Tony McCauley was born in the Protestant end of West Belfast in 1963, and the Troubles began when he was just a small child. His previous book, Bread Boy, looks back on his childhood there, but his latest book jumps forward in time to when the 23-year-old McCauley set out to stop the violence between Catholics and Protestants in Belfast. The book is called Little House on the Peace Line, and McCauley joined us via Skype from his home in Belfast and explained what his plan was back then.
It's the period of 1985 to 1988, and I was 22, 23 years old, and I just graduated from university, and I was just about to get married, and I got my first job, and my first job was as a youth worker in North Belfast at the height of the Troubles, the civil conflict in Northern Ireland. As you may know, in Northern Ireland, we have a very divided city of Belfast between Catholic neighbourhoods and Protestant neighbourhoods. And those neighbourhoods are separated by large fences and walls, euphemistically called peace walls. But in those days, there were many, many peace lines separating the two communities at a time of, you know, great tension and violence. And I was a young, idealistic young man with a real commitment to building peace and trying to make a difference, to stop the violence, to try to find a way of bringing people together. And so I went to live right on the peace line, right beside one of the peace walls. My wife and I got married and we bought our first little house right there. We're both Protestants. And we bought a house on the Catholic side of the peace line. So we went to live on the peace line. We went to live on the opposite side of the peace line from the community in which we had grown up. And I started to work with Catholic young people, and my wife was working with Protestant young people. And we brought them together to meet each other and make friends in our little house. And we called it The Little House on the Peace Line. So that's the name of the new book.
A lot of people hearing this might think, oh my gosh, you're mad. Why would you think to do that in the middle of the violence? And you describe a lot of it in the book. I mean, this is the era of drive-by shootings and people throwing petrol bombs. And it could have been for anything. And there's such a devastating loss of life for no particular reason other than sectarianism. And it must have been difficult.
It was a very dark time. It really was. It was a period of time where it felt like, you know, this conflict was going to go on forever. By 1985, the conflict broke out in 1969. You know, we'd been through a lot of trauma as a community in the preceding decades, and it just seemed to be getting worse and not getting any better. It seemed like we were going to be stuck in this conflict forever. So it was a dark time. In the area that I worked, it was known as Murder Mile, and it was called Murder Mile because it was a mile from the city centre out of Belfast, which had the highest intensity of sectarian killings in the whole of Northern Ireland. And it also was an area, the area that I worked in, it had 90% youth unemployment at that time, partly because of the economy at that time, but partly because of the conflict. Unemployment was a huge problem in Belfast in that era, and particularly unemployment for young people. So people said to me at the time it was a crazy thing to do. When I look back now, I think it was a risky thing to do. It was an idealistic thing to do, and maybe a little bit naive in some ways, to be honest with you, Bonnie. But it's something that I don't regret doing, because very few people in Northern Ireland have had the experience of, you know, walking in the other person's moccasins. It's not an experience that very many people here have had.
And, you know, you would say that that's part of the problem is that, and you make the point in the book over and over in lots of different ways, that you grew up in just as much of a blinded worldview as the people on the Catholic side of things. And if you don't make the effort to learn about the other people and find out that they are just people just like you, you're never going to change.
Yes. So, you know, everyone in my street was a Protestant. When I was growing up, I went to the school, my primary school. Everyone at school was a Protestant. I obviously went to a Protestant church. We played Protestant sports, socialized with Protestants. And, you know, 1 mile away on the other side of a wall, Catholics were going to a Catholic school. They were living in a Catholic street. They were going to a Catholic church, playing Irish sports. Although we lived so close together, it was like living in two parallel universes. And the interesting thing that I discovered when I crossed that divide and went to experience what it was like living on the other side, I noticed that both sides had myths about each other. And we learnt all the prejudices about the other side from our own side. And it was being passed down the generations. And it was really only when I took the step to cross over to the other side that I started to hear things from a different perspective. I got to hear, for me as a Protestant, I got to hear a different experience, for example, of the British Army and the police, who and many people in the Protestant community would have seen those as protecting us from the IRA. Whereas when I was living in the Catholic community, what I experienced there was many people saw the British Army as an oppressive force to continue the historic oppression of Irish people. So it was I got to experience all of that firsthand.
I have to say, it's a very funny book, too, because you are a funny writer. All of your books have this humor, even though you're dealing with such very serious and very dark things. The humor comes out both in the characters that we meet through your work on the Peace Line. I'm thinking of the boys in the youth club. I felt like I got to know them so well, and I wanted to meet them.
Great. Oh, that's good. That's lovely to hear. Because it was important to me that I brought to life their experience and their attitude. And on the one hand, in many ways, they were simply by being born and growing up at this time, they were victims of this whole situation that they were living through. And, you know, so they hadn't got jobs. They often had very, you know, prejudiced views about people who were different, but they'd never had an opportunity to meet someone who was different. In some ways, they'd been brutalized by growing up in a violent society for so many years. Many had lost loved ones, and some of them also were attacked as well in some of these drive-by shootings that you mentioned. So, but at the same time, we do have quite a dark sense of humor in Belfast. And I suppose in a way it helped us to get through the darkest of times. You know, having that sense of humor, that ability not to take ourselves too seriously and to be able to see some humor to get us through the difficult times. It's a very Belfast characteristic.
At the end of the book, you talk about 30 years later going back and seeing the changes that have happened. I know the book is just coming out, but have you been in touch with any of those kids that you worked with 30 years ago? And have any of them read any of this?
Well, some of them came to the Belfast book launch, which was wonderful. I was delighted to see them. And I met up with one of the guys recently who asked me for a signed copy, and I met up with him to give him a copy. And I actually sent a copy to one of the guys who actually is currently in prison in Germany on charges related to the Troubles. So now I haven't had feedback directly so far from them, but I hope they think that I've represented them fairly and with dignity. I mean, one of the young people in the youth club sadly was murdered during the course of the time I was there, and I invited his mother to the book launch because I dedicated the book to him. And his mother and his sisters came along to the launch, and I thought that was really very special. She was delighted that someone was remembering her son, because, you know, there were so many teenagers like him who lost their lives. There's a book here in Northern Ireland called Lost Lives, and it lists everyone who died. And you turn the pages, Bonnie, and there's just scores and scores of young men like him who are in many ways forgotten. It's desperately sad to read that. So I was delighted when I asked his mother permission to dedicate the book to him, that she agreed and she came along to the launch. And in some way it sort of, it let her know that he was being remembered, and he was being remembered with respect, you know, in spite of the, you know, the horrific events that ended his life.
Well, respect and love, I would say too.
Oh, good. Well, I hope that comes across. You know, this was a kid who, his father had been murdered when he was only 2 years old. His father was killed in a horrific pub bombing, and he grew up with that awareness. And of course, that, you know, there was an element of hatred in his heart as a result of that, because of what had been done to his father, and it tortured him. It made him very sad. As a result, you know, he drank too much, and even though he was really a teenager, he was drinking too much, and that part of that was just the trauma of what had happened to his father. And then, you know, he was abused and harassed by others, you know, and they used the death of his father to harass him, which I thought was a terribly cruel thing to do. And then ultimately he himself had his life taken away from him. You know, if he'd been born anywhere else, another period of time, he would have grown up. He'd have met a lovely girl. He'd have got married. He'd have kids now, and he, you know, like some of those other young people who did survive, he could have had a happy life. So it is desperately sad.
What do you think the long-term legacy of all of that is for those boys that you were working with now 30 years on? What are their children absorbing from that time?
Well, I suppose the really positive thing is that we've had a few reunions of the old youth club, and most of those guys have done really well. You know, at the time they were wild. That's the only word I can describe.
Pretty wild, yes.
they were wild, and they were involved in all sorts of things. But most of them have got themselves decent jobs. They have families. Their kids are doing, you know, they're talking to me about their kids doing well at school. And, you know, in spite of the really difficult start that they had in life, many of them have done really well for themselves. And I think that's wonderful. And it's nice when they mention perhaps that you contributed in some way to that by, you know, the in a small way by having some influence on them all those years ago.
And there was one young man at towards the end of the book when it's time for you and Leslie to move on and do other things with your lives. It's Dan, and he basically says, everyone leaves us.
Yeah.
And that broke my heart.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, that, and you know, that's a very vivid memory, him saying that to me, because I was so passionate and so dedicated to what I was doing. But ultimately, he was right. I was choosing to leave. I would have burnt out if I'd stayed there any longer doing what I was doing, and in some ways I had to leave. But it was true, and he said, it's interesting, I met one of the other youth workers who has read the book recently, and he said, you know what, he said that to me a few years later when I left as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, and but he's an interesting person, that particular boy. He's done really well. He's now a governor in an integrated school in North Belfast.
Good for
that's
him.
What he's doing.
That's great.
That's fantastic. That is really good.
I was going to say, that should make you feel pretty proud.
I'm very proud of him that he's done that, and he believes in that, and he's contributing to the peace by being part of that sort of integrated education movement.
What do you think is going to happen now that Brexit is here, essentially, or is in the process of being here? Are you worried that all of the progress over the last 30 years in Belfast and in Northern Ireland in general are somehow going to be wiped away?
I don't think all the progress we've made will be wiped away. I think that the progress, the most important progress of a society, of a violent society to a peaceful society, I think that is, it feels to me that that is irreversible at this stage. No one wants to go back to those bad old days that I've written about. So I think that's irreversible. However, Brexit is a big political challenge for us here. And it'll be an economic challenge as well, because Northern Ireland has benefited greatly from the European Union. There's a special EU peace program, which has funded much of the peace and reconciliation work over the past 20 years. Funny, I drove home from Dublin last night across the border, and it's just a motorway, or a highway, as you would say. You know, you don't even notice that you're crossing the border. So you sort of wonder now, well, are they going to reintroduce, you know, border controls there? Will I have to stop and show my passport? And is that, you know, is that movement across the border going to become more difficult again because it's so easy now? And then I suppose the whole shakeup in terms of the stability of the United Kingdom, where you've got, you know, this possibility of Scotland having another independence vote. You know, it has reawakened the conversation here about a united Ireland much more than it's been the case in the past number of years. So, for example, the majority of people in Northern Ireland voted to stay, to remain in the EU, but obviously
just like
we're
Scotland, yeah,
the same as Scotland. Mm-hmm. And you know, Sinn Féin, the biggest nationalist party here, would be arguing, well, this is a bigger reason than ever why there should be a united Ireland, because if there's a united Ireland, Northern Ireland remains in the EU. So that has become, in a sense, with the 1998 agreement, the constitutional issue of whether there was going to be a united Ireland, in a sense, that had felt quite settled, that, you know, the agreement says that, you know, if it seems there's likely to be a call for that or enough demand for that, there would be a referendum on both sides of the border, and if the majority of people voted for that, then that change would happen. That's what's in the Good Friday Agreement. But it really felt that wasn't something that was, you know, going to, you know, that sort of border pull wasn't something that was going to happen in the, you know, in the immediate future, maybe some years down the line. But the Brexit scenario has brought that forward and much more into the forefront of people's thinking. And in some ways, once our political parties get back into that constitutional issue rather than the social and economic issues, it becomes quite poisonous again, and it can get quite sectarian. Mm-hmm. And people retreat, and, you know, it's about being tough against the other side, and, you know, the population then, you know, basically vote to keep the other side out. And then we get quite stuck politically, and we're quite stuck politically at the minute. We don't even have a government at the minute. They can't agree to form a government at this stage. But there's an interesting phenomenon since Brexit was announced, is that the number of Northern Ireland Protestants applying for Irish passports has increased dramatically, because they want to retain their EU citizenship. And of course, anyone on the island of Ireland can have an Irish passport. I can have an Irish and a British passport. And so many people who would only have had a British passport in the past are now applying for Irish passports as well, so they'll retain their rights as an EU citizen come Brexit.
Mm. Well, that's one way around it, I suppose.
Yeah. that's us being clever.
That's right. Well, if there's an opportunity, you know, I take it. Oh, my goodness. Are you hopeful that things in the future will continue on the good path, whatever form that takes, whether it's reunification or not?
Yeah, I'm still optimistic and hopeful. Things have changed dramatically since my childhood. I mean, my children have never experienced violence or the things that I grew up living with. My children are children of the peace, whereas I was a child of the Troubles. My children were educated in an integrated school right throughout their whole childhood, and that's a huge difference from when I was growing up. So I'm still very hopeful. We've come an awful long way. I suppose I'm still quite idealistic. I would love Northern Ireland to be a really integrated society. We're now a very peaceful society. You know, Belfast is buzzing. Our tourism industry is you know, really thriving. The film industry that's going on in Northern Ireland, you know, with Game of Thrones and everything, is just really exciting. I mean, it's just amazing the difference. But we're still more divided than I'm comfortable with. I would love us to have, you know, I'd love most of our kids to be at integrated schools. I would love Catholics and Protestants to be living in the same streets again. I would love all of those peace walls to be torn down forever. It feels at the minute like we're living alongside each other peacefully rather than really living together happily.
So a little bit of work to do.
Yeah, more work to do. But I suppose one of the things that I've learned over the years, and probably as a result of my experience on the peace line in the 1980s, was that it does take time. Some of these changes are generational. Back in 1995, I could not have imagined the level of peace that we have today. I really couldn't have imagined it. And it's so precious. And I do, as I said, I think it's irreversible. But at the same time, because of my experience of, you know, living on both sides, I think we're really good people. We just need to respect and understand and value each other more. You know, we still don't fully trust our neighbors in the way that I think it would be great if we could.
Well, Tony McCauley, we are so looking forward to having you visit us again. It's been a couple of years since you were at Irish Fest last. I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
My pleasure, Bonnie. It's lovely to talk to you again.
Under the blue moon, I saw you. So soon you'll take me up in your arms too late.
Tony McCauley is a best-selling author, leadership consultant, peace builder, broadcaster, and suicide prevention advocate from Northern Ireland. His newest book is Little House on the Peace Line, Living and Working as a Pacifist on Belfast's Murder Mile.
The official U.S. launch of the book is tonight here in Milwaukee, and McCauley will be talking with people at Irish Fest's literary tent through Sunday.